Hi guys, welcome back to the HYM podcast. We're here with another episode, and but the boys are both out in Europe now, and I'm stuck at home, so it's a bit of a role reversal from earlier this year. But yeah, Jake and Nick are both with us this week as well. So Nick's in Germany and Jake's in Monaco. Yeah. Right then, saying that, boys.
Yeah, well, the episode everyone would have watched, which come out today as we're filming, I was in Germany. Now I've flipped around a little bit, but yeah, I'm in Monaco with the supporting the FB boys this week for the pre-debt. So yeah, just in my hotel looking out of the lovely ocean, Mediterranean. It's what view I've got. I'm not going to turn it around.
It's raining.
No, don't.
Yeah.
No, you can leave that one. But it's a home race for you, isn't it, Jake, this weekend?
Well, not for me personally.
Well,
for the team in Ventura. Yeah, they're the only Monegasque race team in the world. So yeah, they're all looking forward to it. Obviously, the simulator's here as well. So yeah, nice and homely.
And Nick, you've been battering around the Nordschleife last weekend.
Yeah, exactly. Getting ready for the 24-hour race. So last weekend was the first prep race. And then this weekend, I'm back for the 6-hour qualification race. Just trying to get ready to defend the title we won last year, which is the Big 24. So all went well and looking forward to getting back in the car, obviously, this weekend.
Yeah, if you guys listened to the racing show, you would have seen it was just me and Jake on Sunday. Nick was actually available, but he forgot his iPad in the Nürburgring, so couldn't join us. But anyway.
But yeah, on today's episode, if we introduce our guest now, we have a really entertaining bloke. He's a race winner in Formula 4, Formula 3, even Formula Renault, even Formula 2. He's a double-time Macau Grand Prix winner, Williams F1 development driver, and the creator of some of the best radio messages I've ever heard in motorsport. Dan Ticktum, how are you doing, mate?
Hi, everyone. Yeah, very good, thank you. Very good. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, all good.
How do you like that intro?
It's very slick, mate.
It's almost like I've practiced it.
I'll tell you what, they are getting better every week, aren't they?
Yeah, well, no one saw the one I tried with Jack Aitken the first time and I fumbled it.
Oh. I think Aitken was on he was on the Zoom call for about 2 hours because it was one of our early ones and we kept on messing everything up. So
yeah, exactly. By the time we've got proper guys like Dan on, though, we're all polished now.
Use that term very loosely, mate.
So whereabouts are you in the world right now?
I'm just at home, mate. I mean, I've got 8 races this year, so fortunately I'm not as busy as I'd like to be, really. So I'm just trying to keep fit, basically. That's all my agenda consists of, really.
Yeah, I suppose it's something that I've sort of thought about, but now that I'm not racing in F3 or even F2, I've not really bothered to spend too much time thinking about it. But you have lost by 4 weekends, I think, from the F2 season, even though you've gained races.
Yeah, I mean, I've got Monaco in 3 weeks, and then Baku 2 weeks after that, and then I've got like 7 weeks off again, mate. Honestly, it feels like I'm a full time streamer, part time racer. Yeah. Like, that's what it feels like at the moment. But I just when you have a busy season, I haven't really had very many busy seasons, but it's just nice to get into a rhythm, But now I just sort of feel like there's just no rhythm. It's just like I've got an event every 2 months, on average, or 6 weeks, whatever. But it's just, I just want to be doing some more driving, to be honest.
Yeah, because isn't the last race Jeddah one of the last weekends of F1 season?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I think so.
November, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very late on in the year. Yeah, there's another gap after, I think it's probably Sochi or something. I think there's always that 2 month gap though.
Exactly.
So we got that again, but we're not going to some tracks that we should be, really. I think we're missing Spa, which is
nuts. Yeah,
ask me. Just want to be doing more driving, mate. Really. So.
Maybe you should do what old Matteo's doing at Nannini at HWA and doing both championships.
I'm definitely open to doing something if anyone's got a seat. I don't know. I'm happy to do some more circulating, that's for sure. So
should put the advert out then.
Yeah, definitely, mate. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's I suppose I've seen some people say that, the advantage of having that is you've got time to kind of reset and you know, dive into the data with the engineers, look at what you might need to improve. But at the same point, there's only so much you have
I think if you've got weekends back to back, it's difficult to analyze. But if you've got all you need is a week in between, you know, and you go to the factory once and, you know, spend a day or two there, you know, you don't need more than that. And I feel like, especially if you have a bad race and then you've got to wait 2 months again, that's the worst, mate, because all you want to do is just get out and prove that, you know, you've improved with the team or whatever you need to improve.
Just
the wait is agonizing, mate. It feels double as long when you've had a bad race.
Well, especially with the way how fickle the sport is, you know what it's like perception wise you're only as good as your last race, and if you have a bad race at the wrong point in the year and everything gets decided contractually for next year or whatever, and then you have that all gets done and you come back and you win both races or whatever, it's like, well, it was a bit late in a way.
I mean, all the F1 sort of stuff is done around sort of September, October, really, like latest November. So if you're having, you know, if I have a crap round in Sochi or something, then, you know, like you say, you're only as good as your last race. So, but I don't know. I mean, I'd never really get nervous for a race season, but for this one, like, I am, because of the gaps. Like, I just sort of feel like
time to think about
there's not enough races to average out bad luck, if that makes sense.
Like
if you've got a lot of races, the chances of, you know, it all sort of equals out over a season. But with eight races, you know, if you have two or three bad rounds, you know, you're really struggling, basically. So I don't know.
Well, suppose you've got the races, but not the rounds, have you? So if your car's just not quick for that track or whatever, you're struggling as a team, it's gonna
the whole race. I mean, looking at the tracks that are on the calendar, I mean, Carlin are pretty strong at most of them. So, I mean, if you look at last year, so I mean, I think it's a logical move that I've made, definitely. I mean, it is really sort of my last chance to get to F1 this year, so it's a big one.
Yeah, I think you've chosen a good team in Carlin. I mean, clearly in F2 since the new car's been introduced in 2018, it seems like they've had a pretty strong package.
Yeah, I mean, Downs are obviously a great team. I mean, both Carlin and Downs have had 30 drivers or something into F1. It's around that anyway. So you know, they're both very, very good teams. But I mean, Downs just, I mean, saying that they got lost last year is probably a bit disrespectful, really. I mean, we just didn't seem to get a hold of what direction to go down with the 18-inch and the slight changes to the floor and everything. It depends how long we've got, but there's a few sort of things that I think they missed, maybe. But yeah, there we go.
Yeah, you kind of have to take a bit of personal relationship out of it, don't you? Like, if you get, say, because I know Dams, I know your engineer Damien from last year, and I got on really well with Damien, but I know what you mean. It's like you don't have you can't afford a season to learn again effectively, can you? So you've got to be selfish in a way.
Especially for me last year, obviously coming off the bat of being dropped from Red Bull, obviously, you know, to get that seat in itself was, you know, bloody amazing, really. I was very happy. And then it's just a bit of an underwhelming year, you know, like the year started off quite well in Austria. I think I was, you know, fourth or fifth in the championship after the first two rounds or something. So sort of did all right. But then we just struggled, especially on the softer compounds. Just couldn't get the tyre working. Simple as that. Balance was always all right. Balance sheets always just like neutral. But we just got no pace. So that was largely the problem there. But and then we were always good in the races because we don't use the tyre as much. So, yeah, that was very simple sort of story of it. Yeah.
Well, I did do one race actually, but it was the first year of the 18-inch, wasn't it? And there was, you know, it's understandable to assume that not every team got it as bang on as well as other teams, let's say.
Yeah, I mean, most teams will just sort of apply their baseline setup to it because you just get bugger all testing.
And in
the testing that you do get, you get six sets of prime and two sets of option, like, you know, over 3 days. You know, you need to be doing six sets a morning. Cost in the grand scheme of things, it's, you know, a massive issue with this sport, which everyone knows. You know, so I'm not going to drone on about that. But, like, in the grand scheme of things, a set of tyres is what, you know, a couple of grand. You know, for the sake of, you know, 10, 15 grand over a test, You know, it's a hideous amount of money for some tires, but to actually learn about
what you mean,
the car, you know, to actually get a direction to go down. But it was the same in Super Formula. We had a completely new chassis the year I went out there. You know, it was 3 days testing, 4 hours a day. Like, I mean, what is
four
that?
4 hours, that's it.
Yeah, it was like two and a bit hours in the morning, and then one of it got rained off, obviously. So, you know, then it's just
obviously.
And then, you know, I go from in that team, they won the year before. So I was like, oh, this is going to be a good year. And then we get there, and, you know, me and my teammate are P17 and 18, you know, because our baseline setup just didn't work for the new car. And then you just have no testing to find a direction. And then you're lost, and bang, the season started. So
it's so painful that, especially in, especially more in the F3, F2 championships, I think, because you're in the F1 paddock, because you're only on track four times. Well, this year it's changed, but normally you're only on track four times a weekend, and it's just your weekend's done before you've had a chance to catch up normally. Brilliant. I mean, us with HWA and F3, even in 2019, we were a new team. We got pole in our second race, and we were generally quite consistent through the year, and we finished the year quite strongly. We started coming to last year, and we were dog for the first three rounds. And then all of a sudden, from round four to the end of the year, we scored the second most points.
Yeah.
But you had no chance after three rounds because you only had 1 point, you know. So and we would have done the same thing as what you're talking about. We'd pretty much applied the base setup, but you don't have the testing.
I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, when you arrive to a race weekend, you know, you get 40 minutes FP in F2, one set of tyres. So, you know, you literally learn, I mean, you know, pretty much bugger all.
Yeah,
And it's just like you get two push laps. I'm like, there's almost no point. I mean, you know.
There is actually an argument to say, actually, would we just be better off saving all the money anyway and just... learning as we go.
I don't know, like save all the FPs from the year and just do five more test days at the beginning of the year or something where you can actually like learn stuff. I don't know, but anyway, there we go.
And obviously just quickly touch on the first round of the year. You know, the pace, obviously new team, it looks strong. A few little incidents, if I remember correctly. We talked about one of them with the guest from last week. Well, he's come out today, but we talked to him last week, Oscar. But apart from that, pace looked quite good. I think we should be quite encouraged.
Yeah, very strong. I mean, I think a track like Bahrain, like characteristically, Carlin are always quite good at sort of rough surface tracks, basically. I mean, they were good at, you know, at Red Bull Ring as well, and that's the opposite. So, but they've always been strong at Bahrain. So it just felt, I mean, obviously I'd driven the Dams car there, you know, the year before, and I obviously did the test with Carlin, and it's just got more grip all round. Like, they're just getting the tyre working better, basically. It's as simple as that. There's definitely some mechanical differences with the car that are quite easy to feel. I mean, I won't say too much because I don't want to help anyone out or whatever, but...
we can keep secrets.
The first round was very strong. I mean, I think the mistake for me was when I hit Vishaw going into turn one. But, you know, you can imagine, like, the track designers of that track, they're like, right, let's design the most awkward, like, section of corners for the start of a race or at the end of a DRS zone we possibly can, you know, because you're preparing turn two, so you're really slow in turn one. So if anyone's pushing the entry at all, you know, the closing speed, basically. So I went for a move on Zoo, which was, you know... It wasn't stupid, but it was optimistic. You know, it was three car lengths back, but I had the move done, you know, and I was at the apex, but Vishaw was preparing to overtake someone on the next straight. So he was even slower, mate. Like, he must've been doing 30 Ks. He just wasn't moving.
I remember watching the onboard. I mean, I think I even saw on Twitter that you owned up the fact that in the end, it's your mistake, you know, it's not Richard's, obviously.
But if I'm completely honest, mate, like when we got to the start finish line, I can't remember. I remember looking at the data that they were 2 seconds ahead of me. I didn't even look at them. If I'm completely honest, holding my hands, like, all I was focused on was getting the move done on the Zoo. I was like, right, okay, I've outbraked here, good move. Like, oh shit, there's a car at the apex. Like, I didn't even see it really.
Even when I watched the onboard back, I mean, you can even halfway through the braking zone, I remember watching the first time and not even acknowledging that it was going to be Richard that you hit.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? He's still so, But like you say, he was so slow, not in terms of a mistake. He was just
preparing the exit.
It was amazing visually to see how long he seemed to stay at the apex for, which caught you out, obviously.
He was, I mean, I think the fella in front of him, I can't remember who it was now, was defending. So he was like, he was going slow. So then the door was going really slow to get the cut back. So
yeah,
it's just one of those, unfortunately, but it's definitely my mistake, obviously. So
then it happened to you again in race two, was it?
Then it happened to me, and obviously ended my entire race, and you got no penalty at all, which is, you know, by the by. But yeah, I mean, a lot of people said, you know, oh, why was I going so slow preparing the exit? If you watch all the onboards, mate, I'm in the middle of the track. Like, I'm not even on the apex. Like, yeah, I'm slow in the middle, but I'm in the middle of the track. I'm probably a car's length away from the apex, like maybe more. So, like, that sort of rubbishes anyone an argument saying that I was preparing the exit too much, because I was fully expecting that sort of thing to happen. So that's why I gave so much room. But again, it's a racing incident. Obviously, didn't mean to do it, but, you know, it cost me the race. I think I had Lawson in front of me or someone else, and I believe my pace would have been, you know, stronger than theirs, so it probably could have been a win that race, you know. I can't remember any points, but
pace wise it did look good from my point of view as well. But what I would say is always the fans are quickly, you know, down people's throat when they see something, particularly something like F2, which is now so televised. But they also haven't done 300 k's an hour down a straight with DRS and different closing speeds. Yeah. So they don't appreciate how difficult it is to, or how easy, sorry, it is to must misjudge.
I mean, and I'm Dan Tickton, so they're down my
throat. Straight on you.
So it's just sort of like, I don't know, it just sort of compounds the issue a little bit. But anyway, yeah. there's no shying away from it, you know.
But you do get a bit, don't you?
Yeah, but the thing is, though, like, and I will say this, like, on a serious level, people, like, if you actually know me, I'm actually quite a nice bloke. People just think, like, I'm this awful, you know, arrogant, you know, spoiled, whatever they want to think, but I'm really not. Like, no, genuinely. Like, so I think, you know, I'm always making a joke and, you know, I don't know, taking the piss out of someone. But, like, when it actually comes to a genuine conversation, like,
yeah,
you know, I'm actually a decent human being, I think. So,
Again, people just see what they see on the TV, which is a small snippet of an interview that you've just had when you've got out the car and your heart rate's being 180 and you're maybe slightly pissed off because you haven't had a good race. So that's all they see. They don't see everything, you know.
I mean, completely. I mean, when I did get hit by Schwartzman in that race, I got tagged round. I even got, you know, people had a go at me for that radio message, and all I said was, "It was marvellous." Like, I didn't swear, I didn't insult anyone or anything. I just said it's marvellous. Like, you know,
did he say lovely or something as well? Is it marvellous, lovely, or something like that?
Marvellous, absolutely marvellous, I think.
Oh, that was it, That was brilliant. But like what Nick said there, I mean, to be honest with you, that's one of the reasons why we thought it'd be good to start this kind of thing with a podcast, because we see, you know, I've experienced it myself, not probably as much as you, obviously, but we wear a helmet. Nobody sees our face until we get out, unless we're on the podium, which normally means we had a good one. And they just see what happens. They don't know the person. And we thought, you know, that was a good idea, a good reason to make a podcast, because they start to see the people beyond the helmet, effectively.
I mean, the only sort of other big podcast I did was with Noel Miller last year in sort of September, August time. And a lot of people sort of messaged me and basically said, yeah, we didn't expect to see this side of you, all this kind of stuff.
Mm.
And Noel put it very well. He said, you know, a lot of people talk about me, but no one talks to me.
Yeah, like, that's a good way to say it.
A very good way to say it, you know. And I get people, obviously, come on my Insta and slate. I mean, I don't reply very, very often to anyone, but sometimes if I'm bored at an airport or whatever, and someone
the wrong moment.
Yeah, no, I'll just message them and just say, you know, why do you believe me to be a clown? You know, like, why? All I've done is work my bollocks off my whole career to get to this point, and it means something to me. You know, so, like, obviously I'm going to get wound up. And then all of them, I've probably done it about 10 times, and they all go, oh, sorry.
Sorry.
And they're, like, really nice to you. Oh, I'm actually a big fan of you. And I'm just like, oh, it's really sad to see all the hate you get. I'm just like, well, why are you peddling it on my page, mate?
Yeah. You know?
block.
No, but I was just gonna say, it's a bit of a pet hate of mine. Not from because I accept it, like you probably have to do as well. But you know, if you're in F1 and you're racing for Ferrari, McLaren, Mercedes, whoever, you kind of accept it, don't you? Go, it's gonna happen. It's a worldwide sport. It's fans for the fans.
Yeah, not but everyone like you. Yeah.
It's... Yeah, but in F2 and F3, I think people don't realize it's still junior. You know. Yeah. We are still either us, family, sponsors, F1 team, junior, whatever, is paying for that car to go racing. The team aren't paying us. So in many ways, it's like, why did they not treat you the same way as an F1 driver would? But I just don't think they understand quite that.
They don't recognise that, you know, in inverted commas, I've sacrificed my whole life to try and get to Formula One. You know, I've sacrificed my education. I've sacrificed having any friends. I've sacrificed, you know, everything to try and get to Formula One. And I just think sometimes they just, I mean, I'm not asking for respect, you know, because that's not me. But like, I just feel, yeah, exactly what you say. They just don't quite appreciate, you know, the level of stuff going on behind the scenes, you know. And it's just like, I don't know. It's just, well, it's to be honest though, mate. It's a problem, not just in motorsport. It's a worldwide problem. The whole social media thing, you know. Like you see all these people commenting on, you know, politics or whatever. It's just like all we see from politics is what the media tells us. We have absolutely no idea what's going on in the little meetings and everything. And you've got these people giving their full blown opinions. You know, they know nothing.
Yeah, as if
it's just like they shouldn't be allowed to have such strong opinions on something that they're not educated about, in my opinion. But anyway.
No, I agree. I mean, I said it, I think, on an episode we did with Jack Aitken, and something that always sticks in my mind when this kind of topic of conversation comes up is I saw an NFL coach say that, you know, back in the day before social media, to have an opinion, you've had to have done something.
Agreed. Like,
you had to have made money, made a career, been a sports person, been a role model, whoever. But now you don't have to. You just sign it, put your email and password into a social media.
Anonymous as well. It's crazy. I mean, I don't believe in like, you know, massive like hierarchies and stuff, but I believe you've got to have some substance behind your opinion, you know, otherwise it's just not valid at all. You know, but the problem is someone sees something that's funny or hateful, or whatever, and they all jump on the bandwagon and just peddle it forward and forward and forward. I mean, it's just nuts. I mean,
Well, I mean, it's something I asked you over Instagram if it's all right to talk about it as well. But I have a feeling, and you correct me if you think it's wrong, I'm wrong or not. But do you think some of it comes from that season in 2015 about what happened with the 1 year ban?
I would say, I mean, I wouldn't put a percentage on it, but I would say, you know, you reap what you sow, unfortunately. Like, you know, unfortunately, I sort of set my, you know,
precedent.
I set my reputation in stone from, you know, the start of my car racing career, really. You know, and not a lot of people know about that season, really. You know, I mean, the biggest pressure I had was from Red Bull. I was a Red Bull athlete, so, you know, that doesn't mean a large monetarily contribution, but I was basically told by Helmut, you know, if I win that year, I'll have full backing in Formula 3. So I was like, okay, great. You know, so I need to win. Halfway through the season, I'm winning, or four races in or something, I'm winning the championship. And my dad tells me, look, you know, I haven't got 1.2 million quid to pay for F3. So, you know, you need to get this Red Bull stuff, basically. So I had that. So I was like, I was basically
16 years old or something.
Yeah, but 15, 16 years old. I mean,
that's mad.
I mean, what are most 15, 16 year olds doing? You know, smoking a joint in some derelict barn somewhere. Do you know what I mean? Like, but it's true though. Like, you know,
most of them are,
Like, especially in Birmingham.
Yeah, now I've got the weight of like one of the biggest companies in the world, you know, and one of the most successful, you know, racing sponsors ever, you know, knocking on my door offering sponsorship if I win. So, you know, and then halfway through the year, Carlin sort of just started to sort of catch up, basically, and they sort of overtook us, basically. They started to get better. And, you know, on the second to last round of the season, mathematically, I had to finish third in this race to be able to get the championship. And I mean, I won't name names, but this driver, he had hit me off twice before in the season. Once I was in the podium and once I was in the lead. So he'd lost me in, it was about sort of 40 points, you could argue. And if I had those 40 points in that second to last round, you know, I'd still have been second just or something. You know, I'd still be fighting easily for the win. And he got no penalty for that, you know, for that both those times he hit me. And, you know, that his dad was in touring cars and it was like a father-son sort of bit of a
political thing. I know who it is now.
Yeah, it was just, I don't know, it's a bit, I thought it was political and the championship weren't like doing anything about it, basically. So I had that, and I had the Red Bull, you know, then I was doing my GCSEs that year, broke up with my girlfriend. Mate, list goes on. Like, you know, there's no excuse for doing what I did. Like, I deserve to have the book thrown at me. I deserve to be banned. But I got banned for a year. I missed a year of racing. I've served my time. So everyone just needs to shut up now and just move on. You know, it's as that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you said it yourself. It was wrong, and you'd learn your mistake from it, I guess. And you're probably a better person for it, or better driver even for it now.
Completely, yeah. I think so. Yeah, I mean, that year off was a very big reflection, obviously, of what my character is. I mean, I believe, you know, you either have the spark or you don't. You sort of can't teach a spark, but you can teach someone to sort of calm down a bit, basically. So yeah, that's the way I like to think of it, really. So that year is just a character reflection, really. Yeah.
I mean, I wonder how much of it is the fact that it's motorsport, and because what I'm kind of thinking in my head is that why people still, it stays in their head probably what happened there, you know, 6 years later. And I'm trying to compare to other sports, you know, like, let's say these professional football, Premier League footballers that make a mistake, or, you know, they, you know,
like
saw
Suarez, like biting someone, like someone known as biting someone, even though he's one of the most talented footballers ever, or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, these, what he did really bad, but like everyone just still remembers him for that.
Yeah, exactly. And these kind of, I'm thinking these, the Premier League footballers that everyone knows their names, the ones that would have broke COVID rules or stuff like that over the last year or so. And they get the book thrown, I don't remember rightly so at the time, but they get forgiven.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think why that wouldn't be. Maybe because it's a more dangerous sport. I guess what happened in that incident is dangerous.
But no, I mean, well, if you look at when I made contact with him, I made contact with him at 28 miles an hour. So that doesn't make any difference, you know, obviously, really. But I mean, I'm just saying that was the number. But I think that the biggest lesson there, I had to learn that lesson for life. You know, I felt like I was being treated unfairly by the championship, i.e. him not receiving penalties. So I effectively took the law into my own hands. So that's not a lesson I need to learn for motorsport. That's a lesson I need to learn for life. I don't know.
No, we can laugh about that, but you're right.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like, you know, I'm what, 21 now, but I feel like in certain parts of my life in the last few years, I've had to be like a 30-year-old. You know, we have to grow up so quickly. And I think, you know, being banned, you know, has sort of helped that, really. And maybe it has, like you said, you know, a few minutes ago, made me a better character as a result. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I always remember, I think it was your first race back after that, and we were teammates. I'm pretty sure it was your first race back. It was Hockenheim. Hockenheim, end of 2016. Exactly. Yeah. Me, you, and Lando. It's me, you, and Lando.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, that was a fun weekend.
Yeah.
It's the first time I'd met you off.
Yeah. No, we met, I remember, at Carina.
Where was that? Was it a race or a test?
Nürburgring. It was you and Jack. You were both fighting for wins or whatever. And I got this car that was sort of pulled out of the shed that had a massive crack in the chassis.
I got that last two races.
Did you?
Yeah, that was my one. Yeah.
It's called something. And one of the engineers there, Frank, who left there later.
Frank. Yeah, I remember Frank.
He called it the flying something or something.
Flying shitbox.
Yeah, something like that.
Well, I don't mean to bring this up to about my career at this point, because it's your other guest, but I remember five rounds in that year. I was second in Eurocup and leading Alps. And I was ahead of Jack in Eurocup at that point. We were really close to pushing each other the whole year.
Yeah, I remember.
He ended up winning both championships, but the last two rounds in both, I was nowhere. Absolutely nowhere. And like, I remember going to Alps, last round of Alps in Jerez, and there was only like 24 cars. And bear in mind, I was fighting for the leader championship, and I qualified 19th.
Yeah, well, it was exactly the same as me. I was two 5 seconds off you two or something when I did it. And I was like, yeah, 23rd or something.
Yeah, and Frank was running me that weekend because my normal engineer was with, I think, Matt Parry in GP3 at Clash or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And he told me, he was the one that told me, you actually showed it me. But yeah, it was that was interesting. But yeah, sorry.
We've gone off on a tangent, but there's a lot of things to think about in this sport.
Sure. We
digress. For hours.
Yeah, we digress. But that was your first race back, wasn't it?
Yeah, Hockenheim was my first race back. And then I did Macau with Double R. It was 2016, that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it was eighth in the main race after the safety car. And then Beckman, I think he outbraked himself a little bit. And took three cars and just basically took me straight out of the race at the Lisboa, unfortunately. But yeah, I think, talk about Macau forever as well. I mean,
We're going to.
Jump onto it now, because I mean, to win that once is cool, but to have won it twice is even cooler, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think both the ways that I won it were pretty unique, to be honest. I think obviously everyone says 2017 it was all luck, but I mean, if they look to three laps before, I did a move around the outside on Norris and Gunter.
Oh, I remember that.
That was probably one of the best moves I've ever done in my life.
That
won me the race. So, you know, like if I hadn't have done that, you know, I would have finished third or whatever, and Norris would have been Macau GP champion, whatever. But I, you know, I had to do that move, and I made it stick. And for me, that sort of ratifies that win in my head. It's still lucky that two people crashed in the last corner, obviously, but you know, I would have still been very happy with third in that race, to be honest.
The result.
Yeah, exactly. But then the year after, I just dominated it, you know, for want of a better phrase, really, without being arrogant. You know, I just, every time I got in the car, I went out and I was quickest. You know, it's just, I think there was a few things in that 2018 season, you know, like Schumacher's like late form, which denied me the championship, which then denied me the super license, which then kind of denied me a Toro Rosso seat. So that was...
Is that literally how it would that have happened?
If I'd won the European Championship as well, I had to win Macau, European Championship, Macau. So like to get a super license. So I nearly did that. So for people that don't understand why I was so frustrated at how someone can all of a sudden win six races in a row, That's your answer. Because, I mean, I didn't have the contract signed to be in Formula One, but, you know, it was likely. And then...
Wait, you were the lead junior at that point?
Yeah, and then Mr. Albert came along. And then he got what is... I don't know if it's my seat, but I don't know. But he was drafted in last minute, basically. Yeah, anyway, there we go. So, but then, 2018... I was just like, you know, I've lost the European Championship. I've got absolutely nothing to lose. And I just, literally. I just remember that weekend, I just ticked every box, you know, always in bed at the right time, always eating the right things. Just literally, I was like a machine. I barely spoke to anyone. I was just like, I'm going to go and win this bloody race, basically. And
I was in that race.
You were in practice. You were like, you were quicker than me in FP1, no? It was you, then me, then Isla or something. Can't remember that.
So I was thinking then in my head, I topped qualifying one, but it was the year after with the GP3 cars. I was with Hi-Tech. So I was teammates with I finished top Mercedes in the end. I ended up getting
always a bit better there. Yeah, normally
I finished fourth, but
My proudest moment of that weekend is the only person in the old F3 car to get into the 209s. I did a 9.8 in quali, which was like 4.5 tenths quicker than P2. So I was pretty happy with that. Yeah, but no one remembers the 2018 win; they just remember the crash.
It's sod's law, isn't it? It is sod's law.
I literally go out and do not put a foot wrong. No one remembers who won that year. All they remember is that massive crash.
In many ways, that's the story of motorsport, because, you know, there's a lot of people, but there's drivers in F1, you know, that are quite like, let's class them as smooth for a moment. And what I mean by that is just maybe not as exciting, but do the job. But unfortunately,
you mean boring.
Yeah, boring.
They're not Verstappen or Hamilton, basically. Yeah, that's it, isn't it?
They don't do. They wouldn't have done that move Hamilton did in Portimao last week on his teammate.
Kiss the spark. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just that's what fans want to see.
Agreed. Yeah.
And I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, definitely. But yeah, so that was Macau. But how good is that track, by the way? Let's just quickly touch on that.
You cannot beat it. They're the only joy that I've got on a racetrack. I think my favourite car that I've ever driven is the old F3 car, like the one that I won Macau in 2018.
And you've driven Super Formula as well.
I've driven everything. I've driven F1, mate. I drove, you know, the red RB, can't remember what it was, in 2019. So I've driven F1, F2, old GP2, Super Formula, F3, everything. And my favourite car to drive is the old F3 car, just because it's so light. You can just throw it everywhere and it's got the right amount of downforce. It could have a little bit more power. But it's just one of those cars where it's always easy. It's easy to go fast, but to get that last little tenth or so is just... That round Macau, mate, is just the best feeling a racing driver would ever get. And I feel sorry for all the people that now can't have it.
Nick, you didn't do it, did you?
No, I've only done Monaco and street circuits.
You might be able to do it in GT though, right?
Yeah, I think we'll probably go back with the M4 when that's released. I was possibly going to do it with the M6 GT3, but actually they took Joel Eriksson because he'd been there before, which is fair enough. They wanted someone that had been there before. But if I get the chance, for sure I want to go, because I'm usually good at street circuits, so it would be nice.
It's absolutely incredible. Yeah, I would push for that more than anything. I remember
2016 was my first year. Same year. I was with Carlin. I was teammates with like Lando and Kamara and Antonio won it. I remember doing the most amount of prep I've ever done in my life for it. I must have done 10 days of sim or something stupid. And I went there a bit naive, but I was thinking, you know, I'm gonna be good. And I remember coming in after the first run in FP1 and just sitting in the pits. And my engineer Lane, who's now in Formula E actually, I remember him talking to me and no word went in. I was just staring into space, like, what the hell has just happened? I could not at that point as well. I'd only done what 3 or 4 years in cars, but 7 or 8 in racing, so I hadn't experienced anything on the level of it. And it was just like you say, the car was so suited to it, apart from the straights where it feels a tiny bit slow there.
Yeah,
it still feels quick, even.
Yeah, you're doing 80Ks with a toe, it's still fast, yeah.
But the mountain section being so light, you throw it around there,
it's incredible. You cannot beat it. Like, it's the best feeling of any race car ever. It just is.
I mean, with the new, it's called it F3 now, but it's GP3.
I did do 1 year.
Yeah, I remember.
And I got caught up in that FP2 shunt, which then basically all
the car... It was the qualification race.
The car was thrown together for quali. So, and I got out in the last, I think it was 12 minutes of the 40 or something. So I only had one set of tyres. And all the weights were completely off because the car had literally been thrown together. And I was like 13th, I think. The car was all over the place. The steering was like that down straight, you know. But I still qualified well, and I had a really good start. And I was up to 7th at Lisboa, and then my teammate Sargent, he caused, you know, an M25 style shunt at Lisboa. It's really bad.
I'm still salty about it.
I caught you, wasn't it? Who did I hit? You said I never think about luck really, but I honestly believe I'm one of the most unlucky people. Yeah.
I'd done fastest in Q1 on the first day.
Yeah.
And then I was quick in FP2 as well. And then we had a bit of an average quali, but still sick. And I remember I got an average start, but I was behind. I was 7th going into Lisboa behind Miney.
Behind you, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. And
2 behind you or something.
Logan sent it down the inside.
Really hit
over past me. I'd let him go because he was going that fast. I was like, well, you're crashing. He hit Miney, which saved him, but crashed Miney into the wall, which hit him around, and I was the first one to hit him.
Then your car was sticking out, and I just caught the back of your car, and then I was done as well.
Yeah.
I'm 7th, mate, and all right, let's face it, I probably would have, you know, gone forward, you know, and then I would have been top 4-3 for the main race, and I genuinely think I could have won it.
Yeah, it's
I think the only person that weekend who had similar levels of
was Jake.
Mate,
Jake was Vips. Vips was quick.
Vips was flying. Yeah, there was. I always remember that weekend. There was. I always said it was Vips, you, me, and I think Armstrong. I think was pretty quick as well. He'd crashed in Q2.
I remember that.
I remember last race because we'd all started at the back, hadn't we, in the Grand Prix? So I remember we were on the grid. We were on the grid with that dragon dancing around, and we were just absolutely talking rubbish to each other. I think someone would have said, "What's the point?" We're all starting 28th, 29th, probably, in the 12 lap race.
We're more planning about the night later.
I always remember that. Over last race, the last lap, I got a good toe on Max Futrell. Overtook him into Lisboa, and I was like, fuck it, I don't know when I'm going to get this chance to drive his track again. So I went for it, and I did have a toe, but I set the fastest lap, I think. I don't know if it was lap record. But Vips was pretty quick in race one, so it was close. Yeah. But that was...
I just remember, mate, Max just sent me the video of to the group and in the crash in the qualification race, and everyone's just crashed and just stopped, and Max is just parked there because he just can't go anywhere. And he's just like, well, this is brilliant, isn't it? Everyone's just driving off and he's just stopped.
We could talk about Mackay all day. Well, yeah. I could. I know I could.
Yeah.
I want to quickly touch on obviously your first taste of F1 when those tests. I think it was Bahrain and Barcelona.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, in 2019. Yeah, it's very, very special. You know, like the cars are unbelievable. I mean, they're very heavy, which is the only problem. But what I will say is incredible. From Bahrain to Barcelona was 7 weeks. And Red Bull had a lot of not structural problems, but problems with the floor flexing, and we had lots of aero drop out the rear, so the car was very unstable and very affected by the wind a lot. So they were struggling at Bahrain, and the car was pretty twitchy there, to say the least. But then everything's completely redesigned, new bodywork, new floor, everything. Like it's like a new car that I drove 7 weeks later. It just didn't even feel like the same car. And I mean, Barcelona, 1-2-3-4, turn 1-2-3-4 in the new cars is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
You brake, you're doing 330, you brake at 70 metres, 65 metres for turn one, you're fifth going in, mate. It's just got so much grip, it's incredible. Then you get to turn 10 and the downforce isn't working.
Yeah.
Go around quicker turn 10 and the M4, mate, then. Yeah. they're just so heavy, which is a shame. You know, the energy recovery stuff is cool, but I think sort of Formula E should do that, and we should have our proper sport over here where it's massive V12 and everyone's, loving it,
Yeah. Well, Nick's got a comparison, haven't you, with that?
Yeah, a bit with that. But also, I was at a test in 2019. I was driving for Racing Point or whatever it was when you were in the Red Bull. And I drove previously to that 2015 for Force India. And I did a 27.3 in 2015. And I did an 18.2 or 3 in 2019. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, they are so fast. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the power, I mean, obviously it's just over 1,000, I think, when they're in their quali mode. And the first time you do, it is bloody hell, that's quick. But that goes pretty quickly because, Super Formula is very quick. It's 650 horsepower or whatever and a lot lighter. So that feels fast. But it's just the downforce. It's obscene. I know now the floor restrictions, they're a bit slower this year. But last year, was very similar to 19. So, I'm even if I don't get to F1, I can say that I've driven probably one of the quickest F1 cars ever. So, it's, it was pretty special.
Exactly. Yeah. I would do have a funny story about that. So the year before I was in Porsche Super Cup. So we were doing 140, whatever's in qualifying. And then the next time I was at Barcelona, I was in 118. So I've gone out the pits for the first time. Obviously I do a load of sim work. And I've thought, bloody hell, this is fast down the straight. And then I realised that at turn five, I hadn't seen the lights yet on the steering wheel. So I hadn't got anywhere near what the full power was. And then I gave it the big one out of turn five and I couldn't see anything. My brain just wasn't keeping up for the first lap or two. And then suddenly Yeah, and then suddenly it all came back, and I was like, oh, okay, I can drive one of these, but bloody hell, it was fast.
it's amazing though, like when the brain just literally cannot like preempt that difference in power. Like, and the first few times you do it, it is one of the greatest feelings. But then obviously you get used to it. But like, it's quite amazing, really. The brain just sort of gets used to it so quickly. But yeah.
It's stupid how it does. It's because on day two morning, for example, then I'm like, oh, I'd like some more power. Still, the braking is fantastic. Like you say, going into turn one and just being able to brake so late and throw it in and then going flat through two, three is just awesome. But but the power you just get used to so fast is mad.
Yeah. And then, where you were doing Super Formula at the start?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I mean, if we look at power, like you look at the mid 80s, mate, when they were running on rocket fuel, what's it called, toluene or something, and like 5 bar boost pressure, mate, was 1600 horsepower. Like, I'd love to have one of those.
Proper old school, because they used the quali engines, didn't they? So it was like one or two laps, and then it would seize itself, and then you'd put a race.
It's toluene, so it's like if you breathe it in, you get cancer immediately, you know, and they were just like. And it's really bad, mate. Like,
it's really bad.
It's like, it's 300 litres in a race. They were spending 200 grand a weekend just on the fuel. Like, but they could run, mate, not normal boost pressure. I think it was like in the twos or something. And they were running 5 in quali spec, like 5 times atmospheric pressure, mate. It's obscene.
Exactly, but, black smoke pouring out the back.
Yeah. Like,
awesome.
Rocket fuel, toluene. So
literally rocket fuel.
Gross. So just to touch on the fact that was the season where you were doing Super Formula, or began with Super Formula, and that obviously it didn't quite go to plan, did it?
No, it didn't. No.
Is that putting it politely?
There are lots of words I can think that did describe it, but I can't really say them here.
You touched on it earlier, didn't you?
But 19 and 20 were very similar in that I was expecting the team to be great. I was expecting to be quick. And both of those years, something changed and we were nowhere. Or not nowhere with Dams, but like we were nowhere in Super Formula at the beginning. And, you know, very little testing. I wasn't expecting, you know, to win, but I was expecting sort of around top 5-ish. You know, I think it would... And the new car came along. I mean, it was amazing to drive, but it's not amazing if you're P15, P16, you know. And my teammate was Tomoki Najori. So he's not like Yamamoto, but he's polled. He's been on pole a few times. Like he's a handy driver, you know. He's 30 at the time. He's been racing there since, you know, the dawn of time, pretty much. You know, so like I was pretty like on his heels. We're always within a tenth of each other in testing, but it was funny working with the Japanese. Like they didn't seem to want to change anything. All of Yamamoto's crew buggered off to Dandelion the year I arrived, and effectively, from what I've heard behind the scenes, took the good people with them. It's disrespectful, but that's sort of how it is sometimes. We did the three and a half days testing, and you know, we were 1.5 seconds off, and you know, they're changing half degree of, you know, front flap. I'm like, guys, you know, we're not looking for 0.2, we're looking for 2 seconds. You know, we need to be like going from completely open on the diff to completely closed. We need to be trying loads of rake, maybe not, like all these sorts of things. And they just didn't want to sort of deviate from the baseline at all, you know. And I think my sort of urgency to like get them to do something was perceived very negatively, when actually all I was trying to do was, boys, we need to get a bloody move on here. We've got three days to learn the car, and we can't be, you know, changing half degree of wing angle. You know, we need to be learning, you know. And I think, my sort of forthright, I'm not going to say rude, because a lot of people have heard that like I was, you know, rude to them or whatever. It's not at all. It's just, I'm quite curt and to the point, you know. It's just like, we should do this, you know, I want to go in this direction. I want to be better, whatever, you know? So, and that didn't go down too well. And for Suzuka, the first race, I finished 8th somehow. They were sort of trying to chase like loads of rake, you know, and the car was just sort of all floaty at the rear. It was horrible. It was terrible on the tires. You know, we had no tread left. Like, we're pretty much on the canvas on the rear left or something. I can't remember. Rear left. And so then after that, basically, I'd said something, talking about diff actually, that we changed in F3, that they don't like any inside wheel spin, the Japanese, at all. So they're quite locked with all the diff and everything. And we just had this awful mid-corner understeer, you know, even if we've got loads of front wing and everything. I'm just like, guys, it just the rear just needs to just start to overtake me a little bit, you know, and I need some freeness. So after Suzuka, we went to Autopolis and we put everything back standard apart from the diff. Like we like opened it like six positions out of 14 or something. And I was P1 and testing like in FP. So like, and I'd never been to Autopolis. Like, you know, so that I was thinking, right, okay, we found some form. Then qualifying arrived, which is 20 minutes. And there's so many red flags, I can't even count. There was seven people that didn't even make the qualifying, the 107% rule, because they just didn't get a lap in. And we were far down the pit lane, so one of those people was obviously me. And I went out and I was doing purple, green, 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 purple, you know, red flag, green, you know, every time. And then I just didn't get a lap in. So I was 17th, climbed up a few places in the race. And then I was about to tag Cassidy, so I had to avoid that, put a wheel on the grass, spun, done. So that was the end of that race. So my pace was good though. So I was thinking, okay, right. I hit a curb quite aggressively in that race when I went off. So I said to all the guys, you know, just can we lay the chassis, just check everything's all right. It's, you know, when you hit the tub right square at the bottom and it's just one of those
slaps.
Things. Yeah, exactly. You just think that didn't feel great. So I said to the guys and all that, and they said, yeah, we'll do all the checks, we'll do this, you know. I wanted to put it on a rig, but I haven't got a rig over there. But then we went to Sugo and I did a one-off race there the year before and I qualified eighth, you know, my first time there in a Super Formula car. And I got there and I was 19th and I was 1.5 off my teammate, you know, and most of the year I'd either been quicker than him or within a tenth, like literally we're always there or thereabouts. And in qualifier, I literally remember getting out. It's the first time I've sweated on a qualifying lap, I think, ever. I was just like, I have done everything I can there. I was P18. And that was when I was just like, something's going on here. Like, there's, I can't accept that something is not going on. I was looking at all the data. Everything sort of looked sensible. And before I could, I thought the chassis was damaged from the previous race. That's what I thought it was. So we're getting a plan together on Tuesday after the race when I got back to, you know, fly it over to England, the chassis, all this stuff, like to get it tested and everything. And Wednesday morning, I just had an email saying contract termination. So I was just like, I had no say in it at all. No meeting, nothing. It was just like,
and that was from Red Bull, or that was from
that's Red Bull, and that's it. If I'm completely honest, I will be transparent. There was one or two reports that were like one day late, which is just not good enough, you know, when you're being sponsored by such a big team. So, you know, that's not good enough from my side. But apart from that, you know, the only other thing I can think is that the Japanese just didn't get on with, you know, my forthrightness, basically. Mm. So that's the lesson I've learned from that, definitely. But
I think also from your point of view, people don't realize you're actually still 21, which is super young in the grand scheme of things.
19
then. So I am just turned 30, and from the age of 25 to what I know now even has changed drastically, and I'm a completely different racing driver. Definitely, I would say faster than I was at 25 for one, but so much more experienced, that don't make the same silly little errors when I'm, say, under pressure or whatever. So for someone to be criticizing you at 19, 18, 17, when they've never been in a situation before, in my eyes, is a bit wrong, because they just don't understand it.
Completely, yeah. And obviously, you know, I'm very open to talk about, you know, all of this sort of stuff, really, with the whole Red Bull thing. Yeah, it was a massive blow. And there were 3 weeks where I sort of genuinely thought about giving up. And just sort of thought, you know, that's sort of it, really. There's a lot of other things I like in life, you know, so I was sort of thinking, should I go and do something else? But then we just had a very good contact, a guy called Alistair Watkins, who's the son of Sid Watkins, which is the doctor who attended Senna at the crash. So we know Alistair's obviously very connected. He basically just put an email out to all F1 teams to see if we got a bite. And surprisingly enough, we got a bite from a few. Most of them said, I want to see him do well in F2. So they didn't want to do any backing, but there was a couple that were willing to do a deal straight away, and one of them was Williams. And then obviously the deal with Dams came about because I did well with them in GP3 a couple of years before. So hadn't I done those GP3 rounds, they wouldn't have known me and maybe I wouldn't have got that seat. So, and then everything started to sort of fall back into place. And I thought, right, you know, bloody hell, I've got another chance here. Mm-hmm. You know, so, yeah. I mean, I felt very privileged, but in another way, I still felt like I deserved it, if I'm honest. And last year was obviously just a bit disappointing from what we spoke about. But yeah, hopefully this year will be my break, let's say.
Yeah, no, I'm sure you'll have a good one. I mean, you've got some good rounds and good team behind you. I drove for Carlin in GP3 2013 as well, so I know how good Trev runs his operation and all the guys there. So I'm sure they're super, super good, super professional.
I'm very confident in them, you know. I mean, you just never know with this sport. Like, you don't know what Pirelli are doing with all the compounds and all that stuff. Like, there's so many variables out of your control, you know, unfortunately, as a racing driver. But I'm confident that if we do face any problems, you know, we've probably got some of the best bunch of people in F2 that will be able to overcome it quickly. So, yeah.
Exactly. No, you'll be fine. And with the Williams role, what is that now? Obviously, I do a bit.
Development driver is a title. So, I mean, it's just... Yeah. It's a bit of sim work at the moment. I'm going to hopefully do an FP1 or two later in the year, I hope, depending on whether they, you know, need to monetize them, I guess. I'm not sure. I haven't actually really spoken to them about that yet, but hopefully I'll get in the car at some point. And the plan is to go to a few races just to get a bit more like immersed in the team and everything like that. I mean, you know, all things going well this year, I've got a strong chance of being there next year. So, you know,
okay, cool.
Yeah, so it's a big year.
Yeah, and have you actually, I have to bring it up because I've made the swap from single seaters because I didn't make it to Formula One, you know, for whatever reason. Yeah, money, wrong place, wrong time. It's easy.
So many things, so many people who are good enough slip by the wayside. It's painful to see, to be honest, but
exactly, but it's fine. You get a professional career. Have you thought of other avenues that you would maybe want to pursue?
Yeah,
if you don't,
for example? Yeah, I mean, I think I'll cross that bridge from when I get to it, I think. But obviously, I've definitely thought about it. I've thought, you know, I don't think I want to stay in racing for a very long time. I think if I don't get to F1, I'll probably, you know, maybe do some sports cars or some GT stuff. And what I'll probably do, if I'm honest, is like maybe try and get some money and then go and start a business or something. Like, because you know, obviously, effectively, I've learnt my, you know, people go to uni or whatever to study. I'm studying my thing, so I want to get some money out of it, and then maybe I can do something else. You know, but I'm not absolutely sure. You know, once I do go to sports cars, you know, and I'm being paid well, I'm going all around the world. Like, I might think, you know, I'll have 10 years of this if I'm good enough. You know, so. Mm. I mean, who knows? But I love music, you know. Made music for, you know, a long time. I've stopped in the last couple of years because I've been busy, but I'd probably revisit that if not. Probably do something with my dad in property or something. I'm not overly worried if I don't make it to Formula One. Will I spend every day of my life being a bit upset that I didn't? Probably, if I'm honest. But I think everyone does, let's face it, who knows that they probably are good enough to get there and don't. It's very tough. But I mean, you just have to look at, I mean, half the Formula E grid, you know. Not half, but at least five of them, you know, should have been in F1 or in F1 for longer, you know.
Sure.
So, you know, it's just the way that there's 20 seats, unfortunately, and five of them are being, you know, occupied effectively by, you know, billionaires. So, you know, that leaves 15. You know, it's true though, isn't it?
Like, they're true.
Yeah.
So true.
I mean, there's, you know, people slate me for being so honest, but that's all I'm doing. You know, it's just how it is. There are a few drivers that, you know, shouldn't be there, and there are others that should. It's as simple as that.
It always happens, but it's interesting to see you've got other stuff going on, and take it from my point of view, to be able to go and do these other races in sports cars or GTs, you'll love it because it's a completely different way of racing, but it's really, really cool.
And to be honest, I love cars. Like I'm just a massive car, like, you know, road cars, everything. And there's a lot of racing drivers who, you know, a lot of them actually are not passionate about cars. They're just passionate about racing. For me, it's like the opposite. I'm passionate about cars and I just love racing, you know. But I just love cars. So, I mean, the GT stuff, like the GTE cars are so cool.
They are cool.
I just want one on the road, mate, to be honest. yeah, they are very cool. Exactly. Like I said, you know, 5 minutes ago, when I cross the bridge when I get there. Like you say, maybe if I get there and it's obviously a completely different type of pressure, I guess, you know, I mean, I don't know, but yeah, and you would know. I'm willing to definitely give it a very good shot, that's for sure, if I don't get to Formula One.
Yeah. Well, I think seeing Nick from, because when I first met Nick, he was Super Cup going to GTs.
And yeah. Like,
the change, mate, it's like, it's ridiculous, isn't it? You're so much more chilled out.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, obviously it's slightly different in the sense that now getting paid and there's no financial pressure from my side. And once you've done well for a little while, then you have complete trust. Yeah, exactly. You have complete trust from the manufacturer and then it works very nicely back when you're doing GP2, unless you're Formula One backed or Super Cup in the Porsches, the money's coming from somewhere within the family or sponsorship. Yeah. Just different kind of pressure, and then that's released once that's gone. I would say that's the main difference.
It's horrible, all of us, when we're in my position. It's awful. Yeah. I mean, you know, I've got no money. You know, I'm just literally. It's just I'm putting everything. Yeah, it's not the most healthy form of lifestyle. Let's just say that. But yeah, I mean, we'll see. Yeah, I'm doing my best.
No,
exactly. We can see that.
Well, I think we've quickly reached our hour, boys.
Very quickly, actually. Yeah.
I've been really quiet, but to be honest, it's been... I've said it at the start in the other episodes that I've done with people. It's, for me, being in the two-wheel side of things, I understand a lot of that, but I've learned so much about the four-wheel side from Jake and Nick before the podcast, but also from getting the guests on. And to be honest, mate, like, I'd only, you know, before meeting you today, I'd only ever seen the YouTube videos, the rumors. And I was going to put it in the chat and say, like, you know, like, oh, I should say this at the end. But like, I think I'd round it up by this. Dan Ticktum, top bloke. If you don't like him, off. And there we go. So we'll round it off with that.
I'm going to agree with that, to be honest.
He wasn't expecting that.
It has to be said sometimes, doesn't it? Because, like, people get so much flack and so much crap from people in all angles. And you can't judge a book by its cover, can you?
Completely, mate. I'm just a bloke trying to get to the top of my sport. That's all I am.
Right.
You know, I'm no more special than the next Tom, Dick or Harry. You know, I just happen to have some opinions. And unfortunately, we live in a world where truth is not receptive very well or not accepted very well, sorry. So... No. And yeah, like you say, we get a lot of flack for it, unfortunately. So there we go.
Top job. There it is. No, we love it. Dan, we'll definitely push to get you back on here later in the year, do some stuff with you on HYM. We'd absolutely love it. I think that'll be out next week, guys. So that'll be episode 12 on the HYM podcast. But as always, we'll just say a quick thank you for the support. This will be, when this comes out, it'll be our 2 months of HYM. So thanks for all the support of the podcast. It's been received really well, and we're going to keep these churning out, so don't worry about that. But leave a like, a comment, a rating on Apple or Spotify. That really helps. Make sure you subscribe to the YouTube. And we'll keep these coming. But thanks, everyone. Cheers.
Yeah. Cheers, guys.
Cheers. Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Cheers, Dan.
Boys, that was awesome.
Yeah, nice.
I love just sitting back and listening to these. It's great.